Hello, this is your Sun Sounds of Arizona volunteer reader, Joanne Lowney, with today's Wall Street Journal business news for Wednesday, July 2nd, 2025. And here are some of today's business headlines. House Republicans threaten to sink Trump's mega bill. Trump said trade deals would come easy. Japan is proving him wrong. Tesla's global vehicle deliveries are plunged in second quarter. China is quickly eroding America's lead in global AI race. Private sector sheds jobs for the first time in 2 years. Paramount agrees to pay $16 million to settle lawsuit by Trump. Private equity caught in crosshairs of Lee Stefanik's attack on Harvard. The first article I'll read today is House Republicans threaten to sink Trump's mega bill. Tax and spending legislation moves back to lower chamber for another vote, by Alluvia Beavers. House Republicans are already lining up to oppose President Trump's big, beautiful bill, with conservatives and centrists blasting the legislation just hours after Vice President J.D. Vance cast his tie-breaking vote on the Senate version. The number of House Republicans vowing to oppose the Senate version is enough to block the bill's passage, failing a last-minute scramble to negotiate with holdouts and the successful pressure campaign by the president. Only 3 House Republicans need to join Democrats in opposing the bill to sink it. Representative Ralph Norman, a member of the conservative House Freedom Caucus, told reporters about an hour after the Senate bill's passage Tuesday that he wouldn't vote to move the president's tax bill out of the House Rules Committee. The panel is debating whether to advance the bill to a vote in the full House. If it does ultimately make it to the floor, Norman would oppose the bill there as well. Our bill has been completely changed from the IRA credits to the deficit, said Norman, referring to the Biden administration's Inflation Reduction Act. This bill's a non-starter. We want to do this, but this bill doesn't do what the president wants it to do. Norman said he believes there's enough no votes in the House to sink the bill. If House Speaker Mike Johnson fails to get enough members to back it, the House and Senate must work to reconcile the differences. That would likely blow through Trump's self-imposed deadline of July 4th to pass the bill. A crescendo of complaints began building across the disparate wings of the House Republican Conference days before the Senate passed the bill, following an exhaustive 27-hour marathon of amendment votes. The legislation would broadly fund Trump's biggest priorities, including the extension of his 2017 tax cuts, no tax on tips and overtime, and a large funding boost to the president's immigration and border policies. Now the fate of Trump's bill looks rocky as the House GOP prepares to digest a series of changes that were made to a version of the bill that passed the lower chamber weeks earlier by one vote. Conservatives and centrists said they were disappointed with the latest iteration of the bill, despite some being told the Senate would improve it. It's too early to write the bill's obituary. Trump and Johnson have previously persuaded shaky Republicans to support the president's agenda. Johnson repeatedly warned the Senate against changing the bill after successfully wrangling conservatives who were pushing for spending cuts and centrists who were warning against steep changes to programs such as Medicaid and food stamps. The Speaker also repeatedly told House members that they would have a chance to make changes to the bill when it came back from the Senate. "I'm not happy with what the Senate did to our product, but we understand this is the process," Johnson told reporters Tuesday. "It goes back and forth, and we will be working to get all our members to yes. The bill passed, and I think it's going to do very well in the House. We'll see how that works out. But it looks like it's ahead of schedule," Trump said, aboard Air Force One on Tuesday. When asked whether he expects to have to twist arms to get it through the House, Trump replied, "We thought the Senate was going to be tougher than the House. We got there, and we got pretty much what we wanted." There are likely hours of closed-door negotiations ahead. Fiscal hawks argue that the bill irresponsibly expands the national debt, and the Senate bill breaches the red lines they laid out months ago and reiterated in June. Centrists warn that they could risk losing their seats if they agree to the Senate's more drastic changes. The Senate version's deeper policy shifts on Medicaid would leave 12 million people without insurance by 2034, according to the Congressional Budget Office, compared with 11 million people in the House version. While both bills aim to phase out quickly clean energy tax credits for solar and wind companies, the Senate version would have slightly more lax requirements as to when a company can claim the tax credit. The Senate bill would raise the debt ceiling by $1 trillion more dollars than the House's proposal of $4 trillion. The Senate version would have a more substantial impact on the U.S. deficit. According to the CBO, it would add $3.3 trillion to the nation's debt over a decade, compared with the House bill, which would add $2.4 trillion. The nonpartisan budget scorekeeper found before the final changes were made to the Senate bill. Conservatives, including House Freedom Caucus Chairman Andy Harris and Representatives Chip Roy of Texas and Eric Burleson of Montana, are warning that they will block the bill if changes aren't made. "It's not what we agreed to. The Senate must take major changes and should at least be in the ballpark of compliance with the agreed-upon House budget framework," the House Freedom Caucus posted Monday on X. Still, conservatives will have to decide if the bill is unpalatable enough to risk crossing Trump, who has already threatened to find primary challengers to those who block it. Representative Eli Crane of Arizona, a strong Trump supporter, argued last week that Freedom Caucus members want to help the president, but that they also want to be principled. Crane and the other members of the group voted for the earlier House version, with the exception of Freedom Caucus Chairman Harris. Skeptics on Capitol Hill said that they have seen this film before. Fiscal conservatives and other Republicans holdouts say they can't support a bill only for most of them to fall in line when Trump gets directly involved. "I don't think there's any question that House members, Republican House members, are operating in great fear of incurring the wrath of President Trump," former Republican Representative Bob Good of Virginia said in a June interview. Good chaired the Freedom Caucus until he lost his primary race after Trump boosted his GOP challenger. Though Good credits the Freedom Caucus with pushing the bill further to the right and doesn't criticize members of the group for backing it, he said he personally would have opposed it. Write to Olivia Beavers at olivia.beavers@wsj.com. Trump said trade deals would come easy. Japan is proving him wrong. Difficult talks with many nations cast doubt on next week's deadline. "We can do whatever we want," Trump said. By Gavin Bade and Brian Schwartz. After failing to cut trade deal with Japan following weeks of talks, Commerce Secretary Howard Lutnick and U.S. Trade Representative Jameson Greer decided to turn up the pressure. When Japanese officials arrived in Washington in late May, Lutnick and Greer warned them that if the two sides couldn't work out an agreement soon, the conversations might start shifting from easing the tariffs President Trump had recently imposed toward additional punitive measures, according to people familiar with the matter. The Americans said they might demand a cap on the number of vehicles Japan could export to the U.S., a policy known as a voluntary export restriction. But the Japanese officials stood their ground. From the start, they had told the Americans they wouldn't agree to any deal that preserves Trump's 25% automotive tariff according to people familiar with the conversations. That impasse continues. On Monday, Trump appeared to cut off talks with Tokyo, and Japan won't take our rice. And yet they have a massive rice shortage, he posted on Truth Social. Despite Japan importing hundreds of thousands of tons of U.S. rice annually under a WTO agreement, Trump added that we'll just be sending them a letter, a reference to his repeated pledges to dictate a trading partner's what they would have to pay to the U.S. In a Fox News interview the previous day, Trump had suggested what such a letter to Japan might say. Dear Mr. Japan, here's the story. You're going to pay a 25% tariff on your cars, you know? So we give Japan no cars. They won't take our cars. After slapping so-called reciprocal tariffs on dozens of countries on what Trump dubbed a Liberation Day, then putting them on hold, the White House vowed to strike a spate of trade deals before July 9th. The standoff with Japan shows how hard that is turning out to be. Administration officials attempting to negotiate multiple deals have at times contradicted one another about goals and timelines. And Trump has further muddled the picture with references to sending letters, adding to the uncertainty as an appeals court hearing set for late July over the legality of the emergency authority Trump used to impose the so-called reciprocal tariffs. Even if the tariff deadline is in question, on Friday, after Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent indicated some countries could get an extension, Trump injected further uncertainty. We can do whatever we want, he said in a news conference. We can extend it. We can make it shorter. I'd like to make it shorter. On Tuesday, Trump said he's not thinking about extending the deadline. The chaotic situation has left Japan and other countries bewildered, unsure of what the White House wants or when they have to deliver a deal. Thus far, the administration has cut only a limited trade agreement with the UK and struck a tariff truce with China. Hanging over the entire process is Trump's earlier promise to restore the Liberation Day tariffs on countries that don't do deals, potentially triggering another round of market chaos. White House spokesman Kush Desai said the administration continues to work around the clock with our trading partners to renegotiate lopsided trade deals that have left American industries and workers behind, and that the White House is on the brink of securing more deals. Senator Kevin Cramer of North Dakota, a close Trump ally, who said he has discussed the negotiations with Trade Representative Greer, said in an interview that deals might take more time than the administration has let on. It's easy to get the frameworks together, and that's where they are. But in terms of the actual details, it takes a long time, Cramer said, adding that he has confidence in the negotiation process. Maybe they set a little bit of an ambitious expectation. In April, Peter Navarro, Trump's senior trade and manufacturing advisor, said the administration could land 90 deals in 90 days. After the U.S. struck the limited agreement with the U.K. in early May, Trump said he believed the deals would start flowing at a rapid pace. Administration officials looked to Japan to keep the momentum going. Tokyo had signed a trade deal with the U.S. during Trump's first term. U.S. officials believed Japan had an incentive to reach an agreement. A favorable deal could bolster the minority government of Japanese Prime Minister Shigeru Ishiba. The U.S. complicated its negotiating position with Japan after other countries by increasing tariffs as talks progressed, such as in June, when Trump doubled global steel tariffs with no warning for trading partners. Other so-called national security tariffs on products such as lumber, semiconductors, and critical minerals remain in the planning process, making some nations hesitant to strike deals before they are unveiled. The administration's bellicose approach also became a political issue in some countries it was negotiating with, encouraging resistance to the U.S. rather than cooperation. We sometimes forget that other countries have politics too, and trade has a way of spurring on domestic politics because of the direct and indirect effects it has on particular constituencies, said Michael Froman, U.S. Trade Representative under former President Barack Obama and current President of the Council on Foreign Relations. Since Trump paused reciprocal tariffs on April 9th, the leader of Japan's negotiating team, Economic Revitalization Minister Ryosei Akazawa, has visited Washington 7 times. His team has been in near constant contact with staffers for Bessent and Greer, who are leading the U.S. talks together with Lutnick. Trump's reciprocal tariffs for Japan had been set at 24% before the pause, far above the roughly 1.5% average tariffs that had been in place, according to the Richmond Federal Fed, besides seeking a reduction to those. Japan officials have said repeatedly they cannot agree to any deal that doesn't reduce industry-specific tariffs, particularly after the UK received some relief from steel and auto tariffs. In June, after another round of talks, Akazawa said that all U.S. levies must be reduced in any deal. Privately, some Japanese officials worry that agreeing to a deal that doesn't reduce or eliminate both reciprocal tariffs and industry-specific duties might be received so poorly in Tokyo that it could topple the Ishiba government, which is facing a high-stakes election to the Japanese parliament's upper house on July 20th. Any deal that reduces Japanese protections for its prized domestic rice industry could also spell electoral trouble for the Ishiba government. In June, Prime Minister Ishiba flew to Canada for a leadership summit of the Group of 7 industrialized nations hoping to force a compromise, but a meeting between Trump and him yielded no breakthrough. "There are still points where our views remain divided," Ishiba told reporters. "Automobiles are a major national interest, and we will continue to do everything we can to protect such interests." A senior lawmaker in Japan's ruling Liberal Democratic Party said that some of Ishiba's associates are arguing that he should hold firm to his demand for tariff relief in the hope that Trump backs down. Perhaps if financial markets grow unsettled as the end of the 90-day tariff pause nears. A senior Trump administration official said the president's advisors have discussed the possibility of implementing further tariffs on Japan if a deal can't be reached. The two sides appear to remain far apart on key issues like the auto tariffs, said people with knowledge of the talks. As of late June, they hadn't even decided whether any deal would include those levies or focus only on the reciprocal tariffs. An official from Greer's office told the Wall Street Journal, "The administration is prioritizing negotiations with trading partners who have presented more serious offers than Japan has." Canada and the U.S. have yet to reach a deal after Trump doubled tariffs on the country's steel industry without warning in June. A U.S. official familiar with the G7 meeting between Trump and the Canadian Prime Minister, Mark Carney, said each team has more work to do to even come close to a deal, with differences ranging from Canada's digital services tax to its tariffs on dairy products. On Friday, Trump said he cut off negotiations with the Canadian government and that he would notify the nation within a week about the tariffs he would impose. After Canadian officials on Sunday scrapped a plan to implement the digital services tax, the two countries announced they would restart negotiations. The U.S. and South Korea are redoubling negotiating efforts after a new government took power in Seoul last month. South Korea wants relief from tariffs on autos, steel, and aluminum. Its proposed regulations on U.S. e-commerce firms doing business in South Korea have drawn the ire of Greer and the American firms such as Google and Coupang, further complicating negotiations. U.S. negotiators raised the digital trade issue with South Korea's new trade negotiator, Yeo Han-koo, when he visited Washington in late June, said people with knowledge of the talks, but a deal isn't imminent. Elsewhere in Asia, the U.S. is demanding that nations take a hard line against China. The administration is struggling to finalize pacts with Vietnam and Cambodia, despite offers from those nations to reduce tariffs and trade barriers, according to people with knowledge of the talks. The White House wants Southeast Asian nations in particular to prevent China from shipping goods to the U.S. through their countries, to stop Chinese companies from setting up manufacturing and export operations in their countries, and to set their own tariffs and trade restrictions on Chinese goods, according to people with knowledge of the talks. Many of those nations are balking at being forced to choose between the U.S. and China, making any deals on those issues unlikely in the short term. One Asian economic official said the U.S. demands would be difficult to meet, given that the export-led economies in the region are so entwined with both the U.S. and China. The administration has appeared to make progress with the European Union, but domestic political considerations on the continent threaten to hamper Trump's goals. After the Journal reported on a draft agreement to reciprocate trade, setting out possible EU concessions on a range of policy issues, European Commission President Ursula von der Leyen pushed back, saying certain topics legislated by the EU are absolutely untouchable. She said the two sides discussed tariff lines, non-tariff barriers such as standards and norms, and purchases the EU might make. But where it is the sovereign decision-making process in the European Union and its member states that is affected, this is too far, she said. Even some Republicans are growing frustrated with the White House's negotiating strategy. During a recent Senate Appropriations Committee hearing, Senator John Kennedy asked, "Are you or are you not pursuing reciprocity?" When Lutnick said he wouldn't agree to a hypothetical deal with Vietnam that would cancel out all tariffs and trade barriers in both countries. Kennedy later said, "I was confused more after the hearing than before about their negotiating strategy here." Write to Gavin Bade at gavin.bade@wsj.com and Brian Schwartz at brian.schwartz@wsj.com. Tesla's global vehicle deliveries plunged in second quarter. Global vehicle sales fall 13.5% as the electric vehicle maker struggles to reverse months of declining sales, by Becky Peterson. Tesla's global vehicle sales fell 13.5% in the second quarter from a year ago, continuing a steep slide in automotive sales as the company tries to pivot to autonomous vehicles. The final quarterly tally of 384,122 missed analysts' expectations of 387,000 deliveries, according to FactSet. The electric vehicle maker has struggled to reverse months of declining sales, which analysts have in part attributed to consumer backlash against the brand and its chief executive, Elon Musk, whose role in cutting government spending was polarizing. He stepped down from his federal role at the end of May. Tesla shares traded up 2.4% when the market opened Wednesday, following the release of its latest delivery figures. Tesla has turned to vehicle updates and low-cost financing to try to drum up customer interest as it faces increased competition and pressure on its brand stemming from Musk's stint in politics. The EV maker released a refreshed version of its popular Model Y mid-sized SUV in March and a cheaper, pared-down version of the Cybertruck in April. It unveiled updated versions of its Model S and Model X luxury vehicles in June. Tesla's executives have played down Wall Street's concerns about declining sales and shrinking margins, pointing instead to potential upsides stemming from Tesla's investments and its autonomous driving software, which it calls full self-driving, and its Optimus humanoid robot. On June 22nd, Tesla rolled out its long-promised robotaxi service, opening up its new ride-hailing app to a small group of customers, including social media influencers, who took rides in autonomously driven Tesla Model Ys through a limited area of Austin. Though it started with fewer than 20 autonomous vehicles and a standardized fare of $4.20 per ride, Musk has said the program could one day add $5 trillion to $10 trillion to Tesla's market cap. To get there, Tesla needs to keep selling cars, which largely fund Tesla's investments in AI and robotics. Musk said he expects there to be hundreds of thousands of Teslas driving fully autonomously on roads in the U.S. by the end of 2026, many of which would be personally owned vehicles. In his vision, drivers will one day be able to lease their cars to other riders on the robotaxi network, much like Uber or Airbnb. The company plans to start production on its dedicated autonomous vehicle, the Cybercab, as soon as next year. The gold two-seater will be available to customers for $30,000. U.S. results posted by other major automakers on Tuesday showed that sales slowed in June, but not enough to undo the big gains that automakers saw in the first half of the year, as consumers raced to buy new cars ahead of tariffs in earlier spring. EV sales were another story. Ford Motor, Hyundai, and Kia on Tuesday all reported steep drops in EV sales for the second quarter. Ford said its EV sales fell more than 30% in the 3 months ended June 30th, and 12% for the year. General Motors was a rare winner. The company said its EV sales more than doubled to 46,280 in the second quarter from the same time last year. Tesla plans to report its full financial results for the quarter on July 23rd. Last year, Tesla reported its first annual decline in deliveries in more than a decade, with global deliveries falling 1%. The decline continued in the first quarter when deliveries fell 13%, plunging automotive revenue 20%. Tesla's share price has swung wildly in recent months. The stock nearly doubled in the weeks after President Trump's election, sending its market capitalization to a high of $1.5 trillion in mid-December. In the weeks after the inauguration, the share returned to pre-election levels. By spring, it was back over $1 trillion. Write to Becky Peterson at becky.peterson@wsj.com. This is your volunteer broadcaster, Joanne Lowney. If you miss any part of this program, you can get it on demand on our website, sunsounds.org, then click on our broadcast info and audio. You can take Sun Sounds with you. Get our stream and on demand on our new Sun Sounds of Arizona app for Apple and Android phones. And you can hear Sun Sounds on your Echo Dot or smart home device. Now back to the next article. Netflix explores music shows and celebrity interviews in unscripted TV push. The streamer has said has had talks with Spotify about partnering on events. By Jessica Tunkel. Netflix is ascending by offering prestige. TV and movies on demand for a monthly fee. Now it's planning to introduce more of the fare that was core to the cable bundle. The streamer has held conversations with Spotify about partnering on a number of projects such as a music awards show or a live concert series. People close to the conversation said it has also discussed doing big celebrity interviews and shorter turnaround documentaries to capture the news of the moment. Netflix is also rebooting the classic talent contest, Star Search. It is particularly focused on music, with a new show, Building the Band, set to debut next week, and another music competition in the works that it hopes to release in coming months, the people said. Millions of households that cut the cord or never had a cable bundle now rely on Netflix as their go-to home entertainment hub. Netflix is working to ensure that it has something for everyone, from scripted shows and movies to reality TV, comedy, and live programming. Finding family-friendly programming that appeals to global audiences is key to Netflix work building its advertising-supported subscription tier. It found success with Love is Blind, a unique spin on a dating show, and Million Dollar Secret, its version of a Survivor, said Brandon Rieg, vice president of nonfiction series and sports. Jeff Gaspin, who green-lighted The Voice at NBC Universal, is spearheading Netflix's effort to find the next great music competition show and expand unscripted content. The self-proclaimed pop culture nut joined the company last year. Building the Band, hosted by Backstreet Boys member A.J. McLean, will feature musicians auditioning to be in bands. The twist is they don't see one another until they start rehearsing together, according to people familiar with the situation. Think Love is Blind meets The Voice. Netflix also recently announced a trivia-based game show hosted by Neil Patrick Harris called Who's in the Box? While Netflix executives have considered big celebrity interviews, they've debated whether people would tune in when snippets would appear on social media nearly instantly, people familiar with the discussion said. The company is working on a pilot with Daily Beast, focusing on quick turnaround, buzzy non-political news events. Semaphore earlier reported the Daily Beast project. Gaspin said he doesn't expect Netflix to become a full-fledged programmer of news, which the company refers to as information, internally. You can't cover news and be a news organization occasionally, he said. Executives also must decide when it makes sense to do an unscripted show as a live broadcast. Netflix has seen some live events, such as its Mike Tyson-Jack Paul fight last fall, attract large audiences. But that came with technical glitches, as did a Love is Blind reunion show a few years ago. The company did live stream two NFL games over Christmas without any issues. While Building the Band will be on demand, Netflix could make the finale live if there is a second season, Rieg said, and the Star Search reboot will allow fans to vote live. We don't want to do live for live's sake, Gaspin said. We're going to go to do live. We should have a reason. Write to Jessica Tunkel at jessica.toonkel at wsj.com. Car sales cooled in June as Trump bump fades. Shoppers are no longer rushing to get ahead of tariff-related price increases, by Sharon Turlip. The U.S. auto industry's Trump bump was short-lived. New vehicle retail sales appear set to dip in June to the slowest pace in a year, a reversal from early spring when consumers raced to snap up new cars before tariffs kicked in. General Motors, Ford Motor, Toyota, and many other automakers reported their latest sales Tuesday, quantifying the latest twist in the industry's roller coaster ride since the Trump administration rolled out sweeping duties on imported cars and car parts. Tesla and a handful of other car companies have yet to report their June sales figures. Analysts say the muted pace could continue as car buyers face a number of hurdles: higher prices, economic uncertainty, high interest rates, and a depleted supply of new cars and trucks. We didn't really see people trying to beat the tariff in June, said David Crist, general manager of Toyota in North America. Even with the lower June, many automakers saw big gains overall in the first half of the year. The U.S. auto industry had been riding a steady post-COVID recovery, with sales ticking up even as cars and trucks became even ever pricier. Last year's auto sales neared pre-pandemic levels as the industry finally shook off a years-long inventory shortage. The Trump administration imposed a 25% tariff on imported cars and trucks, which took effect in April. Foreign-made parts are also hit with duties, but automakers get a lower rate on those imported parts if the car is assembled in the U.S. Fearing higher prices, many Americans rushed to showrooms. Sales in March and April jumped to their highest number in years. U.S. car buyers bought some 173,000 extra vehicles during those 2 months in an effort to get ahead of tariffs, according to J.D. Power. By mid-May, business began to slow, and the sluggishness continued into June. Things have tapered off a bit, said Sean Hogan, vice president of Sierra Automotive Group, an L.A. area dealership chain. The tariff threat, coupled with Memorial Day sales, proved many car purchases in the months leading up to June, he said. Hogan expects demand will hold up even as tariffs set in, but worries that cars are becoming increasingly unaffordable. He's seeing more buyers shift to mainstream brands from luxury or niche models. Sales of South Korea's Kia, for instance, rose about 5% in the second quarter, while Ford notched double-digit gains. The five biggest car brands gained the most share so far this year, according to Cox Automotive, an automotive service business. If they're not going to go buy a luxury car, they're like, let's get something responsible, Hogan said. The sales slowdown comes even as analysts and dealers say tariffs aren't yet adding to the cost of new cars and trucks. The extent of fallout from tariffs, both on car prices and the overall economy, remains the big unknown headed into the second half of the year. Ford, Subaru, and Toyota have disclosed plans to raise prices, hikes that could add pressure to already high vehicle costs. Buyers paid on average $46,233 for a new car or truck in June, a $1,400 increase from the year prior, according to research firm J.D. Power. Several automakers have cut back on importing vehicles, while North American auto factories are making fewer vehicles. In addition to higher duties, trade wars could hobble availability of key materials, as has been the case with crucial magnets made with Chinese-supplied rare earth elements. If the moves result in significantly tighter supply, vehicle prices could remain high, even if demand cools. There's really been a triple whammy on the consumer, Toyota's Chris said. Write to Sharon Turlep at sharon.turlep, T-E-R-L-E-P, at wsj.com. Sanctioned steelmaker finds a buyer for U.S. Canada plants. Private equity firm to pay up to $500 million for Evraz North America, whose parent company's largest shareholder is Russian oligarch Roman Abramovich, by Bob Tita. The North American business of steelmaker Evraz, whose largest shareholder is sanctioned Russian oligarch Roman Abramovich, will be acquired by private equity firm Atlas Holdings. Atlas said it agreed to pay $500 million, with most of the money deferred pending the performance of the business. Evraz North America produces large diameter line pipe for the energy industry, rails for railroad tracks and other steel products at plants in the U.S. and Canada. The sale removes a question mark around the ownership and operating status of the unit, which has largely functioned on its own for the past 3 years, while its parent company in the U.K. has been unable to conduct business. For Abramovich, who owns 29% of Evraz stock, the sale strips another piece from his business empire. Under pressure from the British government, Abramovich sold soccer club Chelsea FC to an investor group for £4.3 billion, a deal that includes longer-term investment pledges. Proceeds from the soccer club's sale remain frozen. The British government sanctioned Abramovich in March 2022, and authorities accused him of having ties to Russian President Vladimir Putin and businesses that have aided Russia's war against Ukraine. Avraz shares were suspended from trading in London, and in May 2022, the UK separately sanctioned Avraz, saying the company's output was of vital significance to the Russian war effort. The company's market capitalization is about $1.6 billion. Abramovich has denied aiding Russia's war efforts and early in the war attempted to serve as a peace broker between Russia and Ukraine. Abramovich hasn't been sanctioned by the U.S. UK and Canada have permitted Avraz North American business to operate separately from its parent company. Sale proceeds will be withheld from Avraz UK parent until sanctions are lifted, Atlas said. Avraz North America has 3,400 employees and operates a dozen steel plants. The company is a major producer of railroad rail in North America and is constructing a mill to produce long-length rail in Pueblo, Colorado. Avraz's roots in the pipe business run deep in Western Canada, where the company was known for decades as IPSCO. I'm hopeful that the sale will mean that we'll be seeing better investments in our mills and will stabilize our jobs, said Eric Ludwig, president of the United Steelworkers Union at the Pueblo plant where he has worked for 20 years. I'd like to be able to retire from here. Since 2022, industry analysts have viewed Avraz North America as a takeover target. Britain's Office of Financial Sanctions implementation on Thursday issued a license allowing the North American business to be sold to Atlas. The sale will be submitted to Canada for approval. The deal has cleared an antitrust review in the U.S., Atlas said. Greenwich, Connecticut-based Atlas specializes in acquiring underperforming or struggling units of larger industrial companies. Atlas partner Sam Astor said Avraz is a seamless fit with the investment firm's focus. The firm's portfolio includes businesses in automotive products, chemicals, construction, steel, packaging, and food. Write to Bob Tita at robert.tita@wsj.com. The battle to keep consumers means smaller packs of cookies and chips. PepsiCo, Campbell's, and others are shrinking packages with lower-priced options to spur sales. By Jennifer Williams. Consumer goods companies are enlarging their range of products by making them smaller. Diminutive snack and drink sizes are hitting more store shelves as brands try to keep stretched consumers buying with lower price options. PepsiCo now sells Lay's potato chips in half a dozen different size bags, costing from around 50 cents to roughly $5. Campbell's new markets teensy packages of Pepperidge Farm cookies and Goldfish crackers, and Mondelez International has six different Milka chocolate bar sizes with prices from under $1 to $6. Food, beverage, and consumer product companies are hoping that a wider range of shrunken size options can boost overall sales volumes, which have been pressured in recent quarters. Smaller size offerings also tend to have higher profit margins. Consumers are going into small pack sizes to optimize their absolute budget, said Mendelez Finance Chief Luca Zaramella. The $3 to $4 as opposed to the $6 to $7, particularly in snacks, are becoming a clear center of gravity. Consumer goods companies have long tailored packaging for cookies, chips, and other items to a range of four factors: on-the-go or lunch snacking, portion control, affordability. The last one, however, critical in emerging markets for years, has recently become more important in the U.S., according to Rob Holston, head of the Global and America's Consumer Product Sector Group at EY. Though inflation has moderated in recent years, prices on certain foods have remained excruciatingly high. In response, Americans are trying anything from treasure hunt shopping to buying fewer items, shopping less often, and switching to private labels to cut their shopping bills. By offering different sizes of a snack with a range of prices to match, companies aim to bring in new customers and keep existing ones. It's really around looking at purchasing power to make sure consumers can get into the franchise. And once they get in there, as they get more money in their pocket, they're actually moving into higher, larger pack sizes, Holston said. So you haven't lost them just because the original product was unattainable because of pricing. For Mondelez, sales have been pressured as consumers cut back on snacking, executives said in April. Overall, revenue in the first quarter barely rose, edging up 0.2% to $9.31 billion, as strong sales in Europe and Asia, Middle East, and Africa segment offset declines of 8.8% in Latin America and 4.1% in North America. The maker of Milka, Cadbury, and Toblerone chocolate, Mondelez has raised some price tags to offset cocoa prices that have roughly tripled over the past 2 years. Meanwhile, as stretched consumers prioritize essentials in store aisles, some are cutting back on snacks. But price variety is helping Mondelez hold on to those people. The company recently rolled out smaller sleeves of Ritz crackers and Oreo cookies, for instance, which retail for around $3. The snack giant's cookies and crackers category grew roughly 0.3% compared with a year earlier, largely because of the more affordable pack options, executives said in late April. If you are on a tight budget and you favor certain things versus others, particularly when those things cost a little bit more, obviously you tend to prioritize, Zaramella said. We need to be able to hold on to our consumers that have a limited amount of out-of-pocket spend. The CFO declined to disclose how much the company invests in packaging. Campbell's executives see a 2.5-ounce grab pack of Goldfish, which retails for less than $2, as a sweet spot for consumers. Liquor giant Diageo is selling smaller bottles of Juan Helio tequila that executives say appeal to consumers looking to spend less on alcohol. And Lay's potato chip maker PepsiCo, which has for years offered numerous price points in emerging markets, started rolling out even more price tag varieties in the U.S. this spring. Even Costco Wholesale, known for its bulk offerings, is slimming down packages in certain categories to meet consumer preferences. For instance, fresh muffins that used to come in 2 packs of 6 muffins each for $9.99 are now sold as a pack of 8 for $6.99. Muffin sales have grown as a result, said Costco CFO Gary Millerchip. In general, I would say we're always looking for bigger items, he said. But there are examples, like the muffins, where we go a little smaller because that's the right size for the member to give the best value. Still, there are downsides to adding more package sizes. In some cases, consumers clearly see they're getting less. Fewer potato chips, cookies, pretzels, for instance. But not a correspondingly lower price, a tactic known as shrinkflation, that has chafed shoppers in recent years. It can also be expensive to add packaging sizes, but those costs can be minimal or even reduced if done right, said Ken Bowles, group finance chief at Summerfit Westrock, which makes dishwasher pods packaging, soap containers, cereal boxes, and other forms of packaging for some of the largest consumer goods companies. With tweaks such as changing the packaging materials or re-engineering boxes so more fit into delivery trucks, Companies can add sizes and cut spending, he said. Another difficulty is that just as some brands expand their product lineups, retailers are working to reduce the number of products on their shelves, intensifying the already stiff competition for shelf space. Companies want the single-serve option to attract customers, but they also want the multi-pack and several options to drive volumes, said Bonnie Herzog, a senior analyst covering the beverage, tobacco, and convenience store sectors in global investment research at Goldman Sachs. But there's only so much space for some of these categories, she said, and it's harder to come by. Write to Jennifer Williams at jennifer.williams@wsj.com. And now for some opinion pieces. Notable and quotable, the value of protests. In this authoritarian and suffocating climate, where being an American feels like a curse, it is hard to move, let alone imagine, what one can do to transform this horror to good. V. Neve Ensler, writing for Britain's Guardian, June 29th. In this authoritating and suffocating climate, where being an American feels like a curse, where just breathing here feels like complicity with genocide, psychotic imperialism, misogyny, and endless racism, it is hard to move, let alone imagine, what one can do to transform this horror to good. Before No King's Day, there was a part of me that frankly was tired of marching, wondering if these demonstrations really add up to anything. But then, on 14th June, with an estimated 4 million to 6 million people in the streets of America, I realized something profound. Marches and demonstrations are not merely acts of resistance and refusal, but they are community events in which we meet and strengthen our resolve and bonds with our own tribe of like-minded people. They are public moments to show the rest of the world that we are in the majority and we do not want and will not accept a king or genocide in Gaza or precious immigrants being dragged off and separated from their families. They are places to let off steam and make great art and music. Trump seeks to remake the world. He wants as much executive power as possible in the U.S., the top global player, by Walter Russell Mead. 5 months into the most consequential foreign policy presidency since Richard Nixon left the White House, Donald Trump's approach to the world is taking on a definitive shape. First and foremost, restraint isn't part of Mr. Trump's political method. He seeks to accumulate as much executive power as possible at home. He wants the same thing internationally. Far from limiting America's world role, Mr. Trump intends to place the country at the center of international affairs. What Alice Longworth said of her father, Theodore Roosevelt, is true of Mr. Trump, at least as far as his approach to international and domestic politics. He wants to be the corpse of every funeral, the bride at every wedding, and the baby at every christening. That doesn't mean he is neoconservative or a liberal internationalist. The 47th president loathes crusades for democracy, despises multi-international institutions, and treats international courts with the contempt he believes they deserve. While he genuinely hates war, Ms. Trump believes in pressing America's economic, technological, and military advantages as far as he can in pursuit of an expansive vision of the national interest. His presidency is about the concentration of power for maximalist goals. His trade policy, whatever economists say about it, has concentrated, unprecedented power in his hands at home and abroad. At home, he can affect the profitability of almost every company in the U.S. by setting tariffs. Mr. Trump's opponents criticize him for blowing up multilateral trading systems. In their view, that system is better safeguarded American economic interest than a chaotic and fluid system resting more on bilateral and political agreements. We shall see whether Mr. Trump's gamble that he can get better deals bilaterally than the U.S. got through the multilateral system pays off. But what isn't in doubt is that his goal is to maximize rather than restrain American economic power. Mr. Trump's Europe policy shows every quality except restraint. From laying claim to Greenland and repeatedly interfering in European elections to ripping up the trade relationship and threatening to walk away from the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, everything his administration has done has been intended to increase American power in Brussels and beyond. NATO Security Secretary General Mark Rutte has been condemned for comparing Mr. Trump to Daddy, who sometimes has to get tough. But America's president is Europe's daddy now, and he has gotten the old world to jump through more hoops than any of his predecessors in the past 50 years. In the Middle East, Mr. Trump has similarly flouted the restrainer's advice and engaged in a freewheeling and far-reaching policy aimed at reasserting American hegemony while avoiding the long-term military engagements. From bombing Iran and threatening the life of its supreme leader to proposing the mass removal of Palestinians from Gaza and threatening Israel with a dramatic suspension of aid, the president has been a hyperactivist in the region. The Secretary of State Marco Rubio was celebrating the signing of a peace deal between Democratic Republic of Congo and Rwanda last week, highlights the immense ambition that drives Trumpian foreign policy. The world is a stage, and Mr. Trump intends to stand in its limelight. The Congo-Rwanda agreement, which may or may not succeed on the ground, illustrates a hallmark of Trumpian diplomacy, an unconventional and amplified reliance on American economic power to achieve international goals. President Trump and his diplomats seek to unite American security and economic interests. Landing disabling blows against Iran, the weakest of the major revisionist powers, both strengthens the American global position and telegraphs warnings to Moscow and Beijing. So does forcing Europe to rearm. It remains to be seen whether and how Mr. Trump will deploy his preferred elements of American power to assert his primacy over Vladimir Putin and Xi Jinping. China and Russia are the two great powers that most want America's might and its ambitious president restrained. Both these revisionist powers see how Mr. Trump has asserted American dominance in Europe and strengthened the U.S. role in the Middle East. China and Russia perceive Trumpian ambition as a threat and will look to derail any project that would diminish their global clout. The outcomes of this competition are impossible to predict. But one thing is clear, Donald Trump is no shrinking violet, and as long as he sits in the Oval Office, the U.S. is unlikely to retreat from the world. That brings us to the end of today's edition of the Wall Street Journal. I'm Joanne Lowney, your volunteer broadcaster on Sun Sounds of Arizona. Stay tuned for more interesting programs on Sun Sounds.